several years ago now, that wise essayist and writer Marilynne Robinson, author of Gilead and Lila, wrote a compelling essay in the New York Review of Books that put frame and substance to what many of us were thinking then, and I suspect what many of us have thought since. She began with a provocative statement that made me think I couldn't quite go where she was going, but just a few lines later, she had me hooked. America, she began, is a Christian country. This is true, she said, in a number of senses. Most people, if asked, will identify themselves as Christian, which may mean only that they aren't something else. Non-Christians will say America is Christian, meaning that they feel somewhat apart from the majority culture. There are a large number of demographic Christians in North America because of our history of immigration from countries that are or were also Christian. And so we are identified in the world at large with this religion because some of us espouse it not only publicly, but also vociferously. As a consequence, we carry a considerable responsibility for its good name in the world, she said, though we seem not much inclined to consider the implications of this fact. If we did, some of us might think a little longer about associating the precious Lord with ignorance and intolerance and nationalism. These few simple precautions would also make Christianity more attractive to the growing numbers among our people who have begun to reject it as ignorant, intolerant, and nationalistic, as they might reasonably conclude that it is if they hear only the loudest voices. There's something I have felt the need to say, she wrote, that I have spoken about in various settings extemporaneously because my thoughts on the subject have not been entirely formed, and because it is truly painful to me to have to express them. However, my thesis is always the same, and it is very simply stated in two parts. First, contemporary America is full of fear. And second, fear is not a Christian habit of mind. As children, we learn to say, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me." We learn that after his resurrection, Jesus told his disciples, "Lo, I am with you always, to the close of the age." Christ is a gracious, abiding presence in all reality, and in him, we Christians believe, history will finally be resolved. But those who forget God, the one who is the single assurance of our safety, however that word may be defined, can be recognized in the fact that they make irrational responses to irrational fears. There are always real dangers in the world, she wrote, sufficient to their day. Fearfulness obscures the distinction between the real threat on the one hand and on the other, the terrors that beset those who see threat everywhere. It's clear enough to an objective viewer, at least, with whom one would choose to share a crisis, whose judgment should be trusted when sound judgment is most needed. Granting the perils of the world, it is potentially a very costly indulgence to fear indiscriminately. And to try to stimulate fear in others just for the excitement of it, or because to do so channels anxiety or loneliness or prejudice or resentment into an emotion that can seem to those who indulge it like shrewdness or courage or patriotism. But no one, she concluded, no one seems to have an unkind word to say about fear these days, unchristian as it surely is. Fear as unchristian. Yet who among us living through these particular days has not known a bit of fear. We live in frightful times when chaos theory seems to be playing itself out before our very eyes. It's enough to make anyone fearful. But what was it that the angels said to the shepherds in the hills above Bethlehem all those years ago? Fear not. Do not be afraid. It is a gracious word to hear in any moment of darkness and dread. Fear not. Do not be afraid. It's the most frequently repeated command in the New Testament, as Mark reminded us a couple of weeks ago. Fear not. A child cries out from her bed in the middle of the night, and her mother, wanting to comfort, goes and gathers the child in her arms and says, "There, there, don't be afraid." If she had said, "There's nothing to be afraid of," it would have been a lie. For indeed, there's much in our world that can cause fear. There's a vast difference between such a false reassurance and the words, "Don't be afraid." So why should the child not be afraid? Because the mother will hold the child and provide comfort and protection through the scary sounds and shadows of the night. Is there anything that will banish our fears more perfectly than a simple human touch? Patrick Wilson says that it's perhaps the most astonishing news of Christmas, that the same God who made the heavens and the earth, this God whose greatness is so vast that even the heavens cannot contain it, this same God is willing to come among us in order to touch us with gentleness and grace so as to allay our fears. The measureless power that made the heavens and the earth is concentrated in a hand reaching out to touch and save us, as if to say, "Do not be afraid." Tom R. says the reason the angels always say, "Do not be afraid," is not because angels are so scary. It's because we're already afraid. We live, you and I, in a post-9/11, post-Wall Street collapse, post-nuclear-threatened, climate-changing, cancer-battled, poverty-crushed, dementia-stalking, gun-crazy world. We're a people who walk in darkness and live in a land of deep darkness. Who wouldn't be afraid? But here's the thing. When we are afraid, we are not our best selves. When we are afraid, our neighbor may look like the enemy. When we are afraid, no one can be trusted. When we are afraid, we're consumed by what we might lose, and things like joy and forgiveness seem like fantasy. When we are afraid, anyone who is different seems to be a threat. But the angels know something we don't know. They bring us a word from another realm, from the very throne of God, and that word is that love through its very weakness, love through its vulnerability, can disable our fear. Now, it's okay if you brought your fears with you here this evening. It's okay to bring them here, for as Phillips Brooks said, the hopes and fears of all the years are met here in Bethlehem tonight. Most of the time, we can't even acknowledge the fear or the deep sadness. At this time of year, we're so careful to put on the brave face and to hide the fears for the sake of family and friends. It's perhaps an indictment of what Christmas has become, that we're unable to embrace our sadness or our fears openly. That's not the way Christmas began, of course. It began in the midst of a real life in a real village with people who were facing real fears and problems. Matthew, in his gospel, describes the story of Jesus' birth on the very same page with the story of how Herod, that paranoid, egomaniacal tyrant, tried to destroy him. Luke, in the familiar tale that we just heard this evening, paints the lovely picture of the manger side by side with a gloomy picture of oppressive taxation by the occupation forces from Rome. Biblical scholar Hewlett Blower says that Luke particularly wants us to understand that Jesus came to reverse the low expectations of his time. And in Luke's gospel, we see those reversals everywhere. Set in the context of the might of the Roman Empire, Mary and Joseph have come to Bethlehem in response to a decree from the Emperor Augustus, a decree that will then be overshadowed by the angelic announcement to the shepherds. The destiny of history will not be determined in Caesar's Rome, it turns out, but in the little town of Bethlehem, what we know as the West Bank. The theme is continued in the fields surrounding Bethlehem, where we meet a group of homeless shepherds on the graveyard shift, living in the fields, it said, outcast by the religious purists of the day, considered ruffians and riffraff by society in general. These are God's choice to receive the angelic proclamation. No high priest, no chief priest, no member of the Sanhedrin was there. Just the least and the lowest are privy to this revelation. And so reversal strikes again. These terrified shepherds find that they and we need not stand before the deity with fear, for once again, Luke reverses expectations. Do not be afraid, they say. Do not be afraid. The angelic message is good news of great joy for all the people, shepherds included. And it happens in all places in the city of David, not Rome, not Jerusalem, but little Bethlehem. Reversal strikes again. The truth of this message will be established by a sign, they say. This Savior, this Christ, this Lord will be found not in a royal palace, not in the chief priest's home, but as a babe wrapped in bands of cloth, lying in a manger. The Messiah they have waited for has come, not as David Redivivus, but as a helpless boy baby born to a couple of homeless refugees. With each reversal, there echoes time and again the refrain of the angel's admonition to the shepherds. Fear not, do not be afraid. What? Don't be afraid. In this frightful world, in a world awash in death and injustice and racism and oppression, don't be afraid. Yes, says the angel, don't be afraid. And it's a command I claim for each of us this night, this year. Fear not. Fear not, the angel said. Good news of great joy for all the people. If we can somehow take that word to heart, maybe we can begin to replace the fear and the dread so prevalent in these days with something else, something more helpful, more hopeful, something more fitting and more becoming for Christian people, something born of hope and akin to courage. Come back to Marilyn Robinson, but not to the essay I quoted at the beginning, this time to the end of her novel, Gilead, when its pastor narrator, John Ames, pastor, ends his letter to his young son with these words. Theologians talk about prevenient grace that precedes grace itself and allows us to accept it. I think, he said, there must also be a prevenient courage that allows us to be brave. That is, to acknowledge that there is more beauty than our eyes can bear, that precious things have been put into our hands, and to do nothing to honor them is to do great harm. And therefore, this courage allows us, as the old man said, to make ourselves useful. It allows us to be generous, which is another way of saying exactly the same thing. I'll pray, he says to his young son. I'll pray that you grow up to be a brave man in a brave country. I pray that you find a way to be useful. Goodness knows, friends, it's so easy to be cynical and fearful in our day. Our culture is infected with darkness and with gloomy and angry rhetoric. And such rhetoric is so unbecoming for us Christians. There may be much to fear. I won't argue against that reality. But as for me, I'm not going to give in to that fear or to those who try to monger it. When we're afraid, we are never our best selves. We aren't. So I'm going to try my best to remember that precious things have been put into our hands, and to do nothing to honor them is to do great harm. I'm not going to let fear keep me from welcoming the stranger, or living with kindness and openness, or embracing those who are different, or simply trying to be useful in this world. And this night, I invite you to join me. Indeed, I found myself convicted in recent days by a proposal once made by the novelist Alice Walker. She said, if we live in a world in which it is fashionable to be fearful and unloving, then let us strive to live unfashionably. In the spirit of Christmas, I say amen to that sentiment. Fear not, friends. Fear not. Take courage. It is Christmas Eve, almost Christmas morning. Take courage.